No, he's a big boy, and a bug with legs got him out, because bugs can swim. And the hole was in the park, and it moved into the backyard, and he falled in it. A tree burned and left the hole. It was the partial dissolution of Julian's previous infantile personality that was causing his emotional distress. Michaela, upset by his trouble and curious about the disappearance of her baby, was trying to understand what her brother was going through. Her dream represented his transformation as a death and rebirth. First his eyes fell out, then he fell into pieces, then his bones came out. Everything went into a hole which originally inhabited the nearby park. The park by our house was 40 wooded acres. The children and I had gone there at night several times. They found it spooky but exciting. For them, it was the nearest manifestation of the unknown, outside explored and familiar territory. Prime locale for metaphoric application as source of the hole in which transformation takes place. The hole was full of water, whose symbolism we have partially discussed, as the rejuvenating slash destroying water of life. The bug with legs that could swim was, I think, a theriomorphized representation of the very archaic intrapsychic systems that guide or underlie the transformation of more sophisticated cortical or personality contents. The notion that a tree burned and left the hole is very complex. A tree, at minimum, is a sophisticated structure that emerges from basic material, from the ground. It is also commonly used as a metaphoric representative of the essence of the individual human, even of the nervous system itself, as we shall see. The tree, in this case, was therefore also representative of Julian, but in a more impersonal way. It stood for, among other things, the personality that was currently undergoing transformation. Adaptive ability remains necessarily limited to the domain encompassed by a single set of principles, a single pattern of action, a single mode of apprehension. In the absence of capacity to reconfigure present conceptualizations of morality. Morality, description of unbearable present, ideal future, and means of transformation. Such limitation, which is the inability to play games with the rules of the games, means dangerous restriction of behavioral and representational flexibility and increased susceptibility to the dangers posed by inevitable environmental shift, that is, by inevitable reemergence of the dragon of the unknown. Biologically determined capacity for such dissolution and for its satisfactory resolution provides the necessary precondition for the existence of human capacity for qualitative alteration and adaptation. Resolution of crisis, symbolic rebirth, follows attendant upon initiatory dissolution, dismemberment, and death. Iliadis states, "The initiatory operations proper always include the renewal of the organs and viscera, the cleaning of the bones, and the insertion of magical substances, quartz crystals, or pearl shell, or spirit snakes. Quartz is connected with the sky world and with the rainbow. Pearl shell is similarly connected with the rainbow serpent that is, in some, still with the sky. This sky symbolism goes along with ecstatic ascents to heaven. For in many regions, the candidate is believed to visit the sky, whether by his own power, for example, by climbing a rope, or carried by a snake. In the sky, he converses with the supernatural beings and mythical heroes. Other initiations involve a descent to the realm of the dead. For example, the future medicine man goes to sleep by the burying ground, or enters a cave, or is transported underground or to the bottom of a lake. Among some tribes, the initiation also includes the novices being roasted in or at a fire. Finally, the candidate is resuscitated by the same supernatural beings who had killed him, and he is now a man of power. During and after his initiation, he meets with spirits, heroes of the mythical times and souls of the dead. And, in a certain sense, they all instruct him in the secrets of the medicine man's profession. Naturally, the training proper is concluded under the direction of the older masters. In short, the candidate becomes a medicine man through a ritual of initiatory death, followed by a resurrection to a new and superhuman condition. The shaman travels up and down the Axis Mundi, the central pole of the world, the tree of life connecting the lower chthonic reptilian and the upper celestial avian worlds with the central domain of man. This is the constituent elements of experience conceived in an alternative but familiar arrangement, as heaven above, father above, underworld, matter, earth below, mother below. Conceived in the configuration arranged originally by the cosmos-creating hero. The shaman's success at completing the journey from Earth to the domain of the gods allows him to serve the role of psychopomp, intermediary between man and God, to aid the members of his community in adjusting to what remains outside of conditional adaptation when such adaptation fails. The shaman therefore serves his society as active intermediary with the unknown, as the conduit, so to speak, through which the unknown speaks to man, as the agent through which the information which compels adaptive change flows. It is important to note that the shaman's journey into unknown lands must be bounded by return to the community for the voyage to be of value. Otherwise, the prototypal ecstatic experience, central to the shamanic vocation and to creative thought and action in general, is mere insanity, will be regarded socially and experienced intrapsychically as such. Resolution is psychological reconstruction, reincorporation, rebirth on a higher level, with redemptive personal experience intact, but reintegrated in the corpus of current socio-cultural myth and history. The ineradicable anomaly that comprises an eternal aspect of existence periodically undermines the stability of a subset of unfortunate but gifted individuals. Those who maintain their heads during the journey into the underworld return, contaminated by that underworld from the perspective of their compatriots, but rife with possibility for reordering the world. Such recovery is, in essence, the transformation of assumption and value, individual, then cultural. History is an invaluable storehouse of the creative experience and wisdom of the past. Past wisdom is not always sufficient to render present potentiality habitable. If the structure of experience itself was static and finite, like the past, all things would have been conquered long ago, and the lives of the ancestors and their children would differ little in kind. But the structure of experience is dynamic and infinite in possibility. The nature of experience itself varies with time. New challenges and dangers appear out of the future into the present, where none existed before. History, as description of the past, is incomplete as well as static. It must therefore exist in constant conflict with new experiences. The spirit underlying the transmutation of culture resolves unbearable intrapsychic conflict with shattering revelation, first to the individual, then to society at large. The creative individual dies, metaphysically and too often literally, for those who follow him, instead of sharing the common destiny of his peers. Those who bear the initial burden for the forward movement of history are capable of transforming personal idiosyncrasy and revelation into collective reality without breaking down under the weight of isolation and fear. Such creativity is feared and hated and desired and worshipped by every human individual and by human society in general. Creative individuals destroy old values and threaten with chaos, but they also bear light and the promise of better things. It is in this manner that the sacrifice of the revolutionary savior redeems and rekindles the cosmos. The revolutionary hero is the individual who decides voluntarily, courageously, to face some aspect of the unknown and threatening. He may also be the only person who is presently capable of perceiving that social adaptation is incompletely or improperly structured in a particular way. Only he understands that there still remain unconquered evil spirits, dangerous unknowns, and threatening possibilities. In taking creative action, he re-encounters chaos, generates new myth-predicated behavioral strategies, and extends the boundaries or transforms the paradigmatic structure of cultural competence. The well-adapted man identifies with what has been, conserves past wisdom, and is therefore protected from the unknown. The hero, by contrast, author and editor of history, masters the known, exceeds its bounds, and then subjects it to restructuring, exposing chaos once more to view in the process, or pushes back unknown frontiers, establishing defined territory where nothing but fear and hope existed before. The hero overcomes nature, the Great Mother, entering into creative union with her, reorganizing culture, the Great Father, in consequence. Such reintegration and resurrection is, in essence, the metamorphosis of individual and then cultural moral presumption. Cumulative, socially mediated transmission of the past consequences of such creation and intrapsychic reorganization constitutes group identity, culture itself, the canon of assumptions and values that underlie behavior, the eternal shield against the terrible unknown. The hero is the first person to have his internal structure, that is, his hierarchy of values and his behaviors, reorganized as a consequence of contact with an emergent anomaly. His descent into the underworld and subsequent reorganization make him a savior. But his contact with the dragon of chaos also contaminates him with the forces that disrupt tradition and stability. The reigning status quo stability may be only apparent. That is, the culture in its present form may already be doomed by as of yet not fully manifested change. The hero detects the dragon, or at least admits to its presence, before anyone else, and leads the charge. His return to the kingdom of threatened order may hardly be accompanied by praise, however, since the information he now carries, or perhaps is, will appear disruptive and destructive long before it proves redemptive. It is very easy to view the hero as the most profound danger to the state in consequence, and this would in fact be true if the absolute stasis of the state did not constitute a more fundamental danger. Figure 51, the crucified Redeemer as dragon of chaos and transformation, presents the Savior as serpent in keeping with his contamination by the unknown. Figure 52, the socially destructive and redemptive journey of the revolutionary hero, schematically presents the way of the Savior. The individual troubled by anomalous and anxiety-provoking experience is suffering equally from the disintegration, rigidity, or senility of the society within. The decision to mine such experience for significance and to destabilize the socially constructed intrapsychic hierarchy of behavior and values is in consequence equivalent, mythologically speaking, to the descent to the underworld. If this descent is successful, that is, if the exploring individual does not retreat to his previous personality structure and wall himself in, and if he does not fall prey to hopelessness, anxiety, and despair, then he may return to the community, treasure in hand, with information whose incorporation would benefit society. It is very likely, however, that he will be viewed with fear and even hatred as a consequence of his contamination with the unknown, particularly if those left behind are unconscious of the threat that motivated his original journey. His contamination is nothing to be taken lightly, besides. if the exploratory figure has in fact derived a new mode of adaptation or representation necessary for the continued success and survival of the group, substantial social change is inevitable. This process of change will throw those completely identified with the group into the realm of chaos against their will. Such an involuntary descent into the underworld is a very dangerous undertaking, as we have seen, particularly in the absence of identification with the hero. This means that it is primarily those persons who have sold their soul to the group who cannot distinguish between the hero and the dragon of chaos, between the hero and the environmental disaster, the death of the king, the dangerous stranger, or the heretical idea. The more tyrannical the attitude, the more those who hold it hate and fear the hero, victim and beneficiary of the creative illness. Let us lie in wait for the righteous man, because he is inconvenient to us and opposes our actions. He reproaches us for sins against the law and accuses us of sins against our training. He professes to have knowledge of God and calls himself a child of the Lord. Let us see if his words are true, and let us test what will happen at the end of his life. For if the righteous man is God's son, he will help him and will deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. Let us test him with insult and torture, that we may find out how gentle he is, and make trial of his forbearance. Let us condemn him to a shameful death, for according to what he says, he will be protected. Wisdom 2, 12 to 13 and 16 to 20. The tyrannical attitude maintains society in homogeneity and rigid predictability, but dooms it to eventual collapse. This arrogant traditionalism, masquerading as moral virtue, is merely unexpressed fear of leaving the beaten path, of forging the new trail. The entirely comprehensible, but nonetheless unforgivable, shrinking from destiny, as a consequence of lack of faith in personal ability and precisely equivalent fear of the unknown. The inevitable result of such failure is restriction of meaning, by definition, as meaning exists on the border between the known and the unknown. Repression of personal experience, which is failure to update action and representation in the face of an anomalous occurrence, means damming up the river of life, means existence on the barren plain, in the paralyzed kingdom, in the eternal drought. It is personal experience, anathema to the fascist, eternally superseding group categorization and the interpretations of the dead, that is novel and endlessly refreshing. The security of predictable society provides an antidote to fear, but a too rigid society ensures its own eventual destruction. The future brings with it the unknown. Inflexibility and unwillingness to change therefore bring the certainty of extinction. Adaptive behavior is created and or transformed by those driven to resolve the tension inevitably existing between dynamic personal experience and society, driven to resolve the tension between what they know to be true and what history claims. Readaptation during times of crisis does not necessarily constitute simple addition to the body of historical knowledge, although that is heroic endeavor as well. Full readaptation may necessitate revolutionary measures, partial or complete reincarnation, dissolution to constituent elements, and systemic reorganization. Such reorganization alters the meaning of experience and therefore the mythology of history and being. If resolution is not reached in time of crisis, mental illness for the individual or cultural degeneration for the society threatens. This mental illness, failure of culture, failure of heroism, is returned to domination by the unknown, in mythological terms, expressed as involuntary incest, destructive union with the terrible mother. The revolutionary hero opens himself up to the possibility of advancement, to furtherance of his culture's central myth, by placing himself beyond the protective enclave of history and by exposing his vulnerability to the terrible nature of reality. In psychological terms, the hero discovers the limitations of history, discovers the nakedness of the father, Genesis 9:20-25. He must, therefore, challenge history and face what it had previously protected him from. Subsequent contact with the terrible mother means exposure to absolute mortal vulnerability, to the existence and consequence of ignorance, insanity, cruelty, disease, and death. The revolutionary hero faces the reality of his vulnerability and fights a battle with terror. The constant transcendence of the future serves to destroy the absolute sufficiency of all previous historically determined systems, and ensures that the path defined by the revolutionary hero remains the one constant route to redemption. The revolutionary hero is embodiment and narrative representation of the action of consciousness itself. This mythically masculine principle emerges from its identity with chaos and culture and stands as an independently divine phenomenon, equivalent in potential strength to the destructive, generative, protective and tyrannical forces that make up human experience. The hero is the individual who has found the third solution to his existential problems, the alternative to decadence and authoritarianism. When faced with a paradox whose solution is impossible in terms of the historical canon, that established axiomatically predicated hierarchy of values and assumptions, he takes inspired action and transcends his culturally determined limitations. Instead of denying the existence of the problem, and therefore tormenting those who cannot help but posit it, the revolutionary hero accepts the apparently impossible task of solution and of reuniting the warring opposites. He admits the possibility of successful solution not because the problem can be minimized, but because he believes human nature can expand to meet it. Such belief, faith, provides the precondition for courage. His act of voluntary transcendence re-exposes him to the brute force of the unknown and to the anger of the social group, but enables creative action. The hero's ability to risk standing alone, neither rejecting his culture because he is ignorant of its value, nor running away from it in panic because of fear, offers him the possibility of attaining true stature, although not necessarily acclaim or popularity. The true absolute in the individual, which can meet the absolute unknown, is the heroic aspect, which cannot be made finally subject to tyranny and is not ruled by the past. This is the spirit that created civilization, which must not be bound within the individual by abject subjugation to what has already been. The man who stands outside of culture necessarily places himself against nature and the world. This seems a hopeless position, but man knows little of his true potential, and in that ignorance lies his hope. This is the stone which was set at naught of you builders, which has become the head of the corner. Acts 4:11. The rise of self-reference and the permanent contamination of anomaly with death. The appearance of anomaly can be less or more upsetting. Small manifestations of the unknown disrupt relatively small tracts of explored territory. Larger manifestations may disrupt all things previously taken for granted, even things invisible. Upsetting manifestations of the unknown may occur as a consequence of outside forces, geological, meteorological, even cosmological. Similarly, social transformations may upset the stable and familiar. Wars, revolutions, and migrations make the conditional nature of everything taken for granted evident once more. Internal transformations are just as likely to introduce instability. The process of maturation in and of itself is sufficient to disrupt the previously stable and well-adapted personality and the little society of the family. Crises in adaptation may be brought about in childhood at the onset of schooling and first independent contact with the unmediated social world. The hormonal changes and new social demands of youth may likewise transform the happy and reasonable child into the depressed and hostile adolescent. Some internal transformations are also natural and social events. The ever-expanding human capacity for abstract thinking, for example, appears to be a consequence of biological and social forces working synergistically. The human brain has evolved exceptionally quickly from the phylogenetic perspective. The language-mediated interpersonal interaction characteristic of ever-larger human societies has provided that rapidly developing biological capacity with information whose sophistication and breadth is increasing exponentially. This means that the human mind increasingly manifests the capacity to upset itself, to produce revelations, so to speak, that knock gaping holes in the previously sufficient adaptive and protective social and interpsychic structures. The human capacity for abstraction has enabled us as a species and as individuals to produce self-models that include the temporal boundaries of existence. We have become able to imagine our own deaths and the deaths of those we love, and to make a link between mortal fragility and every risk we encounter. Emergence of such capacity, which reoccurs with the maturation of every new human being, introduces the most intractable anomaly imaginable into the developmental course of every life. Myth represents the ever-recurring appearance of this representational ability, this emergent self-consciousness, the heritable sin of Adam, as incorporation of the forbidden fruit, development of knowledge of good and evil, and consequent expulsion from paradise. This appearance is an event of cosmic significance, driving the separation of heaven and earth, making human experience something eternally fallen, something ever in need of redemption. The unknown has become permanently contaminated with death for Homo sapiens. This contamination has tremendously heightened our general motivation, our fear and curiosity, as we are able to perceive the potential that lurks behind every anomalous event. Our cultural creations, our great societies and the beliefs that accompany them, can be profitably viewed as driven by our knowledge of mortality and by the energy, the heightened alertness and penetrating consciousness such knowledge inspires. Our great transpersonal cognitive power, however, has not yet rescued us from the valley of the shadow of death. In the words of Origen of Alexandria, 2nd-century Christian theologian, "What man is found such an idiot as to suppose that God planted trees in paradise, in Eden, like a husbandman, and planted therein the tree of life, perceptible to the eyes and sense, which gave life to the eater thereof, and another tree, which gave to the eater thereof a knowledge of good and evil? I believe that every man must hold these things for images under which the hidden sense lies concealed." The metamythology of the Way portrays the manner in which specific ideas about the present, the future, and the mode of transforming one into the other are initially constructed and then reconstructed in their entirety when such transformation becomes necessary. This metamyth provides the deep structure linking other classes of myths, including those describing the current or pre-existent stable state, those that portray the emergence of something unexpected into that state, those that represent the dissolution of paradise in consequence, and those that describe the regeneration of stability. This cyclic pattern is essentially characteristic of the development of consciousness, of the capacity to act and represent, which is regarded from the mythic perspective as akin to the creation of the world. The previous place of stability, destroyed as a consequence of emergent anomaly, may be apprehended either as the paradise that once reigned from the perspective of the chaos engendered by its collapse, or as the rigid and tyrannical past from the perspective of revitalized and renewed order. Myths of paradise and the fall typically describe the first dynamic elements of the way from the perspective of the chaos presently reigning. That is, from the position of the uncertainty and fear that characterizes profane and worldly life. From this standpoint, human life is existence in the valley of the shadow of death, contaminated by the unbearable and unreturnable gift of the knowledge of good and evil. Myths of redemption, that is, of the ascent from chaos, of the return to paradise, or of the flight to heaven, are tales designed to describe the process of remediation for the prehistoric fall. Such myths lay out a morality whose incorporation or incarnation constitutes cure for the spiritual paralysis engendered by emergent knowledge of death. The idea of primeval paradise, then paradise lost, of the origin of experience, the rise of self-consciousness, then permanent heritable fall, descent from grace, appears as a constant predicate of human culture distributed throughout the world. Even the most technologically primitive of people, whose styles of existence were often mistaken for paradisal by the Europeans who first encountered them, generally considered themselves fallen from an earlier condition of perfection. For them, like us, the noble savage was an ancestral Adamic figure who could communicate directly with God. As Iliada has it, when heaven had been abruptly separated from the earth, that is, when it had become remote, as in our days, when the tree or liana connecting earth to heaven had been cut, or the mountain which used to touch the sky had been flattened out, then the paradisaic stage was over, and man entered into his present condition. In effect, all myths of paradise show us primordial man enjoying a beatitude, a spontaneity and freedom, which he has unfortunately lost in consequence of the fall, that is, of what followed upon the mythical event that caused the rupture between heaven and earth. The idea of paradise encompasses somewhat more than the previous place of stability. It is actually all previous places of stability concatenated into a single representation. Every previous place of stability becomes in this manner order, as such, balanced perfectly with potential, becomes existence without suffering in Eden or paradise in the walled garden of delight. Joseph Campbell notes, Eden signifies in Hebrew delight, a place of delight. Our own English word paradise, which is from the Persian peri, around, deza, a wall, means properly a walled enclosure. Apparently then, Eden is a walled garden of delight. Paradise is the place where the perfect harmony of order and chaos eliminates suffering while bringing forth the necessities and pleasures of life without work or effort. Chaos and order are integrated perfectly in the paradisal state. Paradise therefore also partakes of the state of the cosmos before its division into the ever-warring constituent elements of experience. This uroboric condition or state, conceptualized as a mode of being that is free from or beyond opposition, is also by necessity that place or state of being where suffering, a consequence of limitation and opposition, does not exist. This form of symbolic representation seems somewhat paradoxical, as it is the dragon of chaos that generates dread anxiety when it manifests itself unexpectedly. However, context determines salience, determines meaning in mythology as elsewhere. The conditions of existence, that is, the balance obtained by the forces of order, chaos, and consciousness, not infrequently appear as intolerable in and of themselves. In the state of anxiety and pain characterized by severe grief or depression, for example. From this perspective, the state of non-being, equivalent to identity with pre-cosmogonic chaos, is the absence of all possibility of suffering. In the state of ideation characterizing suicide, for example, the great mother beckons. A student of mine, who had undergone a relatively severe crisis of identity, told me the following story. I took a trip to the ocean. There were cliffs behind the beach. I was standing on one of the cliffs, looking out over the water. I was in a depressed state of mind. I looked out to the horizon. I could see the figure of a beautiful woman in the clouds. She gestured for me to come forward. I almost went over the edge before I came out of my fantasy. My wife told me a very similar tale. When she was in late adolescence, feeling somewhat unsettled, she took a camping trip on the sides of a deep river bank near her hometown. She stayed overnight on a bluff overlooking a steep drop. In the morning, the fog came off the river and filled the valley. She walked to the edge. I saw the clouds below me. They looked like big, soft pillows. I imagined diving in where it was warm and comfortable. But part of me knew better. The state of non-existence, the state before the opening of Pandora's box, can under many conditions appear a state worth reattaining. The common metaphor of paradise as geographic place serves to concretize a complex state of affairs whose intrinsic nature would otherwise remain entirely beyond grasp. It brings down to earth the a priori conditions of the spirit and renders them initially comprehensible, at least in the symbolic sense. Paradise as place or state is perfected interpersonal interaction, the harmony of the lion and the lamb, as well as spiritual harmony, is the internal kingdom and the external kingdom simultaneously united as the kingdom of God. Paradise is also the world before it became profane, before innocence was lost. Myths of the paradise of childhood use the circumstances applying at the dawn of each individual life, prior to separation of mother and child, as metaphor for the place of beginnings. The symbiotic mother-child relationship is a union of elements that will in time become separate. The intimate union of two individuals at the beginning of a life comprises a state that is one thing and more than one thing simultaneously. This concrete example of a unity that is at the same time a plurality can be used in abstraction to represent the hypothetical pre-temporal state itself, where everything that would be more than one thing still existed in inseparable identity. This unity, the unviolated original state, tends to take on the affective evaluation of perfection, since it is the place where there is no conflict, no separation of opposites. Widespread iconic representations of the Holy Virgin Mother and Child, for example, Christian and non-Christian, might be regarded as crystallized fantasies about the affective nature of the origin. In the ideal mother-infant union, every desire remains absolutely bounded by love. The state of early childhood, more generally, symbolizes freedom from conflict, symbolizes honest, innocent, idyllic human existence, immersion in love, life before the necessary corruption of social contact, life preceding exposure to the harshly punitive conditions of physical existence. Childhood represents, perhaps is, existence prior to the discovery of mortality. This lack of contamination by knowledge of death lends childhood experience an ideal quality, which easily comes to serve the mythic imagination as model for the state of being that transcends the existential anxiety of adulthood. The child, father to the man, represents the past of man. Additionally, represents human potential and man's eternal hope for the future. The Hasidim believe, for example, that the tzaddik, the perfect righteous man, finds that which has been lost since birth and restores it to man. In the Christian tradition, likewise, it is held that, except ye be converted, and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 3:3. Maturation means expansion of ability, differentiation of self and world, transformation of possibility into actuality, but loss of potential as well, as anything developed develops in one direction and not in any of the innumerable alternatives. Growth, therefore, also means decline, as each step toward adulthood is one step closer to death. The initial paradisal state is typically disrupted in mythological representation by some fateful act undertaken by man, by some act that places him in opposition to his heavenly source. Such opposition is painful and is often portrayed as a dreadful mistake or sin. It is nonetheless the case that the origin of experience and history, that is, the origin of being itself, appears inextricably bound up with such opposition, with differentiation from the origin. The initial paradisal state, although characterized by absolute totality, nonetheless seems paradoxically flawed. It suffers from an indeterminate form of non-existence, lacks reality itself. There was something formless, yet complete, that existed before heaven and earth. Without sound, without substance, dependent on nothing, unchanging, all-pervading, unfailing. One may think of it as the mother of all things under heaven. The Tao Te Ching. Such non-existence appears as an inevitable consequence of the absence of limitation or of opposition. This absence deprives whatever constitutes the origin of a point of reference distinguishable from itself, and, therefore, deprives it of existence. As a place, as the previous state of innocent being, paradise retains a patina of carefree existence. This is diminished by the comparative unreality of that existence. Things have not yet fallen apart in the Garden of Eden, have not yet separated completely into their constituent elements. Two things that cannot be discerned from one another are not two things, however, and one thing with no discernible features whatsoever may not even be. Paradise is the world before it has become realized. In such a state, nothing suffers and nothing dies, because there is no defined one to suffer, no one aware of either the nature of subjective being or the meaning of such being once it has become detached from the whole. The primordial ancestor, simultaneously male and female, dwells in this unrealized place prior to division into husband and wife, exists unself-consciously even after that division. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Genesis 2:25. To know nakedness and to be shamed by it is to understand exposure, weakness, and vulnerability. To be exposed before a crowd and the world is to have the essential frailty of individual being dramatically and incontrovertibly demonstrated. To be unaware of nakedness, to lack self-consciousness, is to be much less troubled, but also to be much less. The paradisal world of the child is much less manifest, that is, than the world of the adult. The child has fewer responsibilities and fewer defined concerns than the adult. This lends childhood a glamour that mature existence lacks, at least from a certain adult perspective. But it is also the case that the child has a terrible vulnerability that the adult has transcended. The child does not explicitly perceive his vulnerability and therefore does not suffer until that vulnerability tragically manifests itself. The adult, by contrast, knows he can be hurt and suffers constantly for that knowledge. His heightened consciousness, self-consciousness really, means that he can take steps to ensure his healthy survival, however, even though he must, in consequence, worry for the future. The world of the child is circumscribed, incompletely realized, but nonetheless vulnerable. The paradisal world is incomplete, yet threatened in the same manner. It is primordial separation of light from darkness, engendered by logos, the word, equivalent to the process of consciousness, that initiates human experience and historical activity, which is reality itself for all intents and purposes. This initial division provides the prototypic structure and the fundamental precondition for the elaboration and description of more differentiated, attracting and repulsing pairs of opposites. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. Genesis 1:1-4. Light and darkness constitute mythic totality. Order and chaos in paradoxical union provide primordial elements of the entire experiential universe. Light is illumination, inspiration. Darkness, ignorance and degeneration. Light is the newly risen sun, the eternal victor of the endless cyclical battle with the serpent of the night. It is the savior, the mythic hero, the deliverer of humanity. Light is gold, the king of metals, pure and incorruptible, a symbol for civilized value itself. Light is Apollo, the sun king, god of enlightenment, clarity, and focus. Spirit opposed to black matter. Bright masculinity opposed to the dark and unconscious feminine. Light is Marduk, the Babylonian hero, god of the morning and spring day, who struggles against Tiamat, monstrous goddess of death and the night. Light is Horus, who fights against evil and redeems the Father. Light is Christ, who transcends the past and extends to all individuals identity with the divine logos. To exist in the light means to be born, to live, to be redeemed. To depart from the light means to choose the path of evil, spiritual death, or to perish bodily altogether. Myth equates the origin of the universe of experience with the partition of light from darkness because of the analogical or metaphorical identity between that separation and the mysterious differentiation of conscious experience from unconscious non-awareness. Awareness and daytime experience are inextricably united, like oblivion and the night. Darkness places severe, uncontrollable external transpersonal limitations upon waking human awareness by eliminating or dramatically restricting visually dependent temporal and spatial sensory extension. The blackness of the night brings with it the reemergence of the unknown and the eternal human sense of subjugation to those terrors still incomprehensibly embedded in experience. When sacred night sweeps heavenward, she takes the glad, the winsome day, and folding it, rolls up its golden carpet that had been spread over an abysmal pit. Gone, vision-like, is the external world, and man, a homeless orphan, has to face in utter helplessness, naked, alone, the blackness of immeasurable space. Upon himself he has to lean, with mind abolished, thought unfathered. In the dim depths of his soul he sinks, for nothing comes from outside to support or limit him. All life and brightness seem an ancient dream. While in the substance of the night, unraveled, alien, he now perceives a fateful something that is his by right. Russian poet Fyodor Chichev. External cosmic forces veil the day with the night. Similarly, and as a consequence of equally uncontrollable and impersonal internal forces, consciousness vanishes into sleep in the night, as states Northrop Frye. The central metaphor underlying beginning is not really birth at all. It is rather the moment of waking from sleep when one world disappears and another comes into being. This is still contained within a cycle. We know that at the end of the day, we shall return to the world of sleep. But in the meantime, there is a sense of self-transcendence, of a consciousness getting up from an unreal into a real, or at least more real, world. This sense of awakening into a greater degree of reality is expressed by Heraclitus as a passing from a world where everyone has his own logos into a world where there is a common logos. Genesis presents the creation as a sudden coming into being of a world through articulate speech, another aspect of logos, conscious perception, light and stability. Something like this metaphor of awakening may be the real reason for the emphasis on days, and such recurring phrases as, "and the evening and the morning were the first day," even before the day as we know it was established with the creating of the sun. The temporary nocturnal state of non-existence appears similar to the more permanent situation theoretically prevailing prior to the dawn of awareness as such, where there was no subject, no object, and no experience at all, but where the possibility of such things somehow lay dormant. There is no suffering in the Garden of Eden. In such a state, however, things do not really exist. In consequence, myth appears to have equated the establishment of the opposition necessary to being with the appearance and evolution of the limited subject who serves creation as the mirror of God. In the mythic world, the very existence of experience, past, present, and future, appears dependent upon experience of the spatially and temporally limited observer. Restricted in their manifestation in this manner, that is, manifest in the domain of individual experience, things attain a brief, differentiated existence before they crash into their opposites and vanish forever. An ancient Midrash states in this vein that God and man are in a sense twins. The modern physicist John Wheeler states analogously, "In every elementary quantum process, the act of observation, or the act of registration, or the act of observer participancy, or whatever we choose to call it, plays an essential part in giving tangible reality to that which we say is happening. Paradoxically, the universe exists out there, independent of acts of registration. But the universe does not exist out there, independent of acts of registration. From the standard perspective, objective things exist in and of themselves. But this viewpoint eliminates the necessity of the observer who gives to all things a necessary vantage point, reducing indefinable virtuality to extent actuality. Myth makes no such mistake, equating the very presence of being and becoming with the emergence of consciousness and self-consciousness. It is this equation that allows the mythic imagination to place man at the center of the universe, and to draw an analogy between the principle that makes order out of chaos and the individual himself. The mythic world, the world as it is experienced, might in fact be considered an emergent property of first-order self-reference, might be regarded as the interaction between the universe as subject and the universe as object. Myth equates the origin with the dawning of light, with the emergence of consciousness, equates the universe with the world of experience, assumes that the subjective is a precondition of the real. This idea seems exceedingly foreign to modern sensibility, which is predicated upon the historically novel proposition that the objective material in and of itself constitutes the real, and that subjective experience, which in fact provides source material for the concept of the object, is merely an epiphenomenal appendage. However, it is the case that self-referential systems, like that consisting of being as subject and object simultaneously, are characterized by the emergence of unexpected and qualitatively unique properties. The world as subject, that is, the individual, is an exceedingly complex phenomenon, more complex by far than anything else excepting other subjects. The world as object is hardly less mysterious. It is reasonable to regard the interaction of the two as something even more remarkable. We think, matter first, then subject, and presume that matter, as we understand it, is that which exists in the absence of our understanding. But the primal matter of mythology, a more comprehensive substance than the matter of the modern world, is much more than mere substance. It is the source of everything, objective and subjective, is matter and spirit united in essence. From this perspective, consciousness is fundamental to the world of experience, as fundamental as things themselves. The matter of mythology therefore seems more than superstition that must be transcended, seems more than the dead stuff of the modern viewpoint. Furthermore, the world of experience appears generated by the actions of consciousness, by dawning awareness, in more than one stage. The purely conscious awareness, which hypothetically exists prior to the generation of active representations of the self, that is, which accompanied the mere division of object and subject, still retains essential unity and associated paradisal elements. Adam and Eve exist as independent beings prior to their fall, but still commune with the animals and walk with God. Sheltered in an eternally productive garden, blissfully ignorant of their essential nakedness and vulnerability, they exist without anxious care or toil. It is the emergence of second-order self-reference, awareness of the self, self-consciousness, which finally disrupts this static state of perfection and irreversibly alters the nature of experience. The development of consciousness, the apprehension of the system by itself, adds one form of self-reference to the universal structure. Self-consciousness, the apprehension of the subject by himself, appears to have added another. The modern mind would consider nothing fundamental altered by such internal transformation, as it considers consciousness epiphenomenal to reality. The mythological mind adopts another stance entirely, presuming as it does that consciousness is allied with the very creator of things. From this viewpoint, cognitive transformations alter the structure of existence, change the very relationship between heaven and earth, creator and created, permanently restructure the cosmos itself. The modern materialist would consider such a theory arrogant and presumptuous, to say the least. Nonetheless, the great societies of East and West are predicated precisely upon such a viewpoint, upon myths of origin and fall characterized by uncanny structural parallel. The father of Prince Gotama, the Buddha, savior of the Orient, determined to protect his son from desperate knowledge and tragic awareness, built for him an enclosed pavilion, a walled garden of earthly delights. Only the healthy, the young, and the happy were allowed access to this earthly paradise. All signs of decay and degeneration were thus kept hidden from the prince. Immersed in the immediate pleasures of the senses, in physical love, in dance and music, in beauty and pleasure, Gotama grew to maturity, protected absolutely from the limitations of mortal being. However, he grew curious despite his father's most particular attention and will, and resolved to leave his seductive prison. Preparations were made to gild his chosen route, to cover the adventurer's path with flowers, and to display for his admiration and preoccupation the fairest women of the kingdom. The prince set out, with full retinue, in the shielded comfort of a chaperoned chariot, and delighted in the panorama previously prepared for him. The gods, however, decided to disrupt these most carefully laid plans, and sent an aged man to hobble in full view alongside the road. The prince's fascinated gaze fell upon the ancient interloper. Compelled by curiosity, he asked his attendant, "What is that creature, stumbling, shabby, bent and broken, beside my retinue?" And the attendant answered, "That is a man, like other men, who was born an infant, became a child, a youth, a husband, a father of fathers. He has become old, subject to destruction.